Part 10. Combining Faith with Reason.
In spite of my doubts, I still clung to the Orthodox Church. But questions of life arose which had to be decided, and the decision of these questions by the Church obliged me at last to renounce Orthodoxy. These questions were, first, the relation of the Orthodox Eastern Church to other churches. At that time, in consequence of my interest in religion, I came in contact with Catholics, Protestants, Old Believers, Molokans, and others. Among them, many men of lofty morals who were truly religious. I wished to be a brother to them. And what happened? That teaching which promised to unite all in one faith and love told me that these men were all living a lie, and that what gave them their power of life was a temptation of the devil. This offense is so obvious to us educated people who've lived in countries where various religions are professed and have seen the contempt, self-assurance, and invincible contradiction with which Catholics behave to the Orthodox Greeks and to the Protestants, and the Orthodox to Catholics and Protestants, and the Protestants to the other two, and the similar attitude of Old Believers, Pashkavites, Shakers, and all religions, that the very obviousness of the temptation at first perplexes us. One says to oneself, it is impossible that it is so simple and that people do not see that if two assertions are mutually contradictory, then neither of them has the sole truth which faith should possess. There is something else here. There must be an explanation. But no one gave me any explanation. The ecclesiastics of all the different creeds told me nothing but that they believe themselves to have the truth and the others to be in error, and that all they could do was to pray for them. I went to archimandrites, bishops, elders, and monks, but none of them made any attempt to explain the matter, except one man, who explained it all, and explained it so that I never asked anyone any more about it. Is it not possible, said I, to understand Christian teaching in a loftier way, so that from its height the differences should disappear? Can we not go further along a path like the one we are following with the Old Believers? They emphasize the fact that they have a different shaped cross and different alleluias and a different procession round the altar. We reply, you believe in the Nicene Creed and the seven sacraments, and so do we. Let us hold to that, and in other matters, do as you please. We have united with them by placing the essentials of faith above the unessentials. Now, with the Catholics, can we not say, you believe in so-and-so and so-and-so, which are the chief things? As for the filioque clause and the Pope, do as you please. Can we not say the same to the Protestants, uniting with them in what is most important? My interlocutor agreed with my thoughts, but told me that such concessions would bring reproach on the spiritual authorities for deserting the faith of our forefathers, and the vocation of the spiritual authorities is to safeguard in all its purity the Greco-Russian Orthodox faith. And I understood it all. I am seeking a faith, the power of life, and they are seeking the best way to fulfill, in the eyes of men, certain human obligations, and they fulfill them in a human way. However much they may talk of their pity for their erring brethren, and of addressing prayers for them to the throne of the Almighty, to carry out human purposes, violence is necessary. What is to be done with a sectarian, burning, in the opinion of the Orthodox, with the fire of false doctrine, who in the most important affair of life in faith misleads the sons of the Church? What can be done with him, except to cut off his head or to incarcerate him? And I turned my attention to what is done in the name of religion, and was horrified. The second relation of the Church to a question of life was with regard to war and executions. At that time, Russia was at war, and Russians, in the name of Christian love, began to kill their fellow men. Killing is an evil repugnant to the first principles of any faith. Yet the teachers of the faith acknowledge killing to be an act resulting from the faith. Besides the murders during the war, I saw during the disturbances which followed the war, church dignitaries and teachers and monks who approved the killing of helpless, erring youths. And I took note of all that is done by men who profess Christianity, and I was horrified, and I ceased to doubt, and became fully convinced that not all was true in the religion I had joined. And though I saw that among the peasants there was a smaller admixture of the lies that repelled me than among the representatives of the church, I still saw that in the people's belief also falsehood was mingled with the truth. But where did the truth and where did the falsehood come from? Both were contained in the so-called holy tradition and in the scriptures. Both the falsehood and the truth had been handed down by what is called the church. And whether I liked it or not, I was brought to the study and investigation of these writings and traditions, which till now I'd been so afraid to investigate. On this teaching, religious doctrine rests, or at least with it the only knowledge of the meaning of life that I had found is inseparably connected. However wild it may seem to my firm old mind, it was the only hope of salvation. That there is truth in the teaching is to me without question, but it is also certain that there is falsehood in it. And I must find what is true and what is false, and must disentangle the one from the other. I am setting to work upon this task. The conclusions to which I come will form the following parts of this work, which, if it be worth it and if anyone wants it, will probably some day be printed somewhere. 1879. The foregoing was written by me some 3 years ago. A few days ago, when revising it and returning to the line of thought and to the feelings I had when I was living through it all, I had a dream. This dream expressed in condensed form all that I had experienced and described, and I think, therefore, that for those who have understood me, a description of this dream will refresh and elucidate and unify what has been set forth at such length in the foregoing pages. The dream was this. I saw that I was lying on a bed. I was lying on my back. I began to consider how and on what I was lying. And observing my bed, I saw I was lying on plaited string supports attached to its sides. My feet were resting on one such support, my calves on another, and my legs felt uncomfortable. I seemed to know that those supports were movable, and with a movement of my foot, I pushed away the furthest of them at my feet. It seemed to me that it would be more comfortable so. But I pushed it away too far and wished to reach it again with my foot, and that movement caused the next support under my calves to slip away also, so that my legs hung in the air. I made a movement with my whole body to adjust myself, fully convinced that I could do so at once, but the movement caused the other supports under me to slip and to become entangled, and I saw that matters were going quite wrong. The whole of the lower part of my body slipped and hung down, though my feet did not reach the ground. I was holding on only by the upper part of my back, and not only did it become uncomfortable, but I was even frightened. And then only did I ask myself about something that had not before occurred to me. I asked myself, where am I? And I began to look around, and first of all to look down in the direction in which my body was hanging, and whither I felt I must soon fall. I looked down and did not believe my eyes. I was not only at a height comparable to the height of the highest towers or mountains, but at a height such as I could never have imagined. I could not even make out whether I saw anything there below, in that bottomless abyss over which I was hanging, and whither I was being drawn. My heart contracted, and I experienced horror. To look thither was terrible. If I looked thither, I felt that I should at once slip from the last support and perish, and I did not look. But not to look was still worse, for I thought of what would happen to me directly I fell from the last support. and I felt that from fear I was losing my last supports, and that my back was slowly slipping lower and lower. Another moment and I should drop off. And then it occurred to me that this cannot be real. It is a dream. Wake up! I try to arouse myself, but cannot do so. What am I to do? What am I to do, I ask myself, and look upwards. Above, there is also an infinite space. I look into the immensity of sky and try to forget about the immensity below. And I really do forget it. The immensity below repels and frightens me. The immensity above attracts and strengthens me. I'm still supported above the abyss by the last supports that have not yet slipped from under me. I know that I am hanging, but I look only upwards, and my fear passes. As happens in dreams, a voice says, "Notice this. This is it." And I look more and more into the infinite above me, and feel that I am becoming calm. I remember all that has happened, and remember how it all happened. How I moved my legs, how I hung down, how frightened I was, and how I was saved from fear by looking upwards. And I asked myself, well, and now am I not hanging just the same? And I do not so much look round as experience with my whole body the point of support on which I am held. I see that I no longer hang as if about to fall, but am firmly held. I ask myself how I am held. I feel about, look round, and see that under me, under the middle of my body, there is one support, and that when I look upwards, I lie on it in the position of securest balance, and that it alone gave me support before. And then, as happens in dreams, I imagine the mechanism by means of which I was held, a very natural, intelligible, and sure means, though to one awake, that mechanism has no sense. I was even surprised in my dream that I had not understood it sooner. It appeared that at my head there was a pillar, and the security of that slender pillar was undoubted, although there was nothing to support it. From the pillar, a loop hung very ingeniously and yet simply, and if one lay with the middle of one's body in the loop and looked up, there could be no question of falling. This was all clear to me, and I was glad and tranquil. And it seemed as if someone said to me, "See that you remember." And I awoke.
A Confession was read by Joss Ackland. The producer was Claire Campbell-Smith.